and you're here because you have to be here, rather than that you thought the first lecture was so exciting that you were compelled to come back. However, I'm going to assume that you wanted to be here. And what I'm going to talk about, I was accused of being pessimistic in the first lecture, and in a sense I am. But actually, it's a pessimism from my point of view as a user, as a practitioner. I think what I want to try to get across to you is the excitement of the challenges which face you. And these are largely embodied, at least at the very top end, by this thing called the Exascale Challenge. So what's Exascale? Exa is the next thing up in the System International, the one that goes above PETA. So Exascale is 1,000 petas, as it were. And therefore we're talking about machines which are on the order of 1,000 times faster than the fastest machines that are available in the world today. That's the system. But let me sort of recap on what parallel computing looks like if you went into it today. At the top end, essentially what you would have would be a set of microprocessors. Each would have their own distinct memory. They would all be pretty much the same. Wherever you look in the cabinet of the machine, you'd see the same type of microprocessor. So a pretty homogeneous environment. Each of your microprocessors would run some form of Unix-like operating system. It might be a microkernel, but it would be pretty standard Unix-like thing. You would find that if you wanted to transfer data between these microprocessors, of course you have to transfer data, that you would do it with some form of library. MPI message passing interface would do explicit message passing, or you'd use OpenMP, which would do it through shared memory. You would program this machine in Fortran or C with these library add-ons. And if you were being really quite sophisticated, you'd use a hybrid programming model in which you try to combine the MPI to do explicit passing of data between microprocessors, and OpenMP, which would let you use the memory on an individual microprocessor to pass data between one core and another. But this hybrid model is still relatively rare, but on the uptake. So that's the environment that you would be programming in today. Very few of those things that you're using, whether it be the operating system, the numerical method, all of those sorts of things, very few of them would have been designed with parallelism in mind. You would have inherited something from the days of serial computing, and the parallelism would then be your problem as the application's programmer to try to use in the application. And so we've done pretty well, actually. I mean, to be fair, a lot of code's been developed, many of them are running really rather well, using effectively this reuse method of serial code, serial methods. I think that we're close to a tipping point, a point where the old methodologies are no longer scalable, and that, if you like, is at the core of the pessimism, that we need to move forward from here. We need to move forward on a whole variety of fronts, and that's the other side of that coin. That's the optimism and the call for new computer science inputs in the future. So, why do we want to go to exaflops? Well, if I were cynic, and many people have thought that I am cynic, they would say that actually the real reason between that I'm going for exaflops is that it's become an easy way to get money out of governments, especially in the US, where the US has both
people who want exaflop computers, mostly, most vociferously in the military, who want to do things that we can't talk about with them, but also they have companies who could build them. And so from a US perspective, putting money into this helps both manufacturing industry and the end users, and so it's a pretty good thing for them to do. So the cynic would say it's a piece of hype designed to extract dollars. The other view, the sort of the scientific view, tells you that there are a whole range, as we discussed in the last lecture, there are a whole range of applications that need more computer power than we can ever manage to throw up, and that therefore they themselves will justify the revolution to come. It's actually quite hard to make that argument in practical terms, because if you have a look at the codes that are around today, very few of them will even scale to a teraflop, a millionth of an exaflop. And that's really what I was saying earlier about being close to the tipping point. If we have applications that could use exaflops, need exaflops in order to actually produce results, but the codes won't scale, we need to put a lot of computer science research into how we move from where we are today to where we want to be. And I identify the sort of the key groups that need to make fundamental research breakthroughs. We have engineers who will have to, if this is to be practical, come up with new designs for the microprocessor hardware, new designs for faster networks. You guys will have to come up with new and better compilers. You'll have to make some sort of breakthrough in software engineering to make the code more robust. Autonomic computing, self-healing computing, all these sorts of areas. The list we'll come back to in the next lecture. The list is almost endless. And lastly, the mathematicians will have to do something in coming up with a new generation of numerical algorithms. I said that there were lots of applications that needed exaflops, but without justifying it. If you're Intel, you produce this sort of picture that says, well, we have these applications in medical imaging, genomics, weather prediction, which don't stop at an exaflop, you will notice. In fact, the exaflop is only the midpoint, and they want zetaflops, 1,000 exaflops, and they predict that they will have them by around about the year 2029. This is good Intel marketing, and I think if it were not backed up by a number of real experiences, I'm not convinced I would believe this slide terribly much. So let's go out and talk to real companies with real problems and see what they want. So if you go to Total Oil, for example, they'll tell you that in order to improve oil recovery through better reservoir characterizations, that is, to understand how the oil is in the rocks more effectively, they require PFAS by 2020. There's a particular problem, and when you think about oil in reservoirs, you might think about oil in a, as you have water in the bottle, you stick a syringe in or something, you suck the oil out. Well, it doesn't actually quite work like that, and because the oil is embedded in the rock. And often what you have to do to get the oil out is you have to press something in, like mud or something. But the fluids that you push in have lower viscosity than the oil itself, and so actually, if you're not very careful, what you do is you press this seawater, let's say, in to push the oil out, and all that happens is you press seawater in and get seawater back out again. So if you don't understand the structure of the reservoir, you can't milk it for you can't boil it for all of the oil that's actually in there. So they want this, and they believe that it will pay dividends.
If you talk to Airbus,
they want computers like this on a very similar time scale to Total, because what they want to do is to design planes more effectively in the computer. At the moment, if you try to do a plane design, you'll do what's called CFD, computational fluid dynamics, modeling how the air moves over parts of the plane, typically the wing, because that gives you the lift, or around spots, hot spots on the plane, particularly difficult areas such as the engines, because obviously what you want to do is to give a plane which has as much lift as possible with as little drag as possible. But that type of calculation, they don't want to do simply on bits of the plane, they want to do on the entire plane, and they want to link it into the structural analysis of the plane itself. No good if this wing gives you an awful lot of lift at relatively low air resistance, but the plane structure means that as soon as you try to fly, the rings get ripped off. So they would like to run structural analyses of the integrity of the airframe together with the fluid dynamics. To do that over an entire plane, very, very demanding computationally. And so they believe that they can cut down on development costs if they do it in silicon. Nuclear reactor design. You can go through the same sort of arguments. You need to understand how the reactor works in more detail if you're to improve the power efficiency and so on and so forth. And indeed, in one application that I'm writing at the moment, which actually relates to nuclear reactors, but actually nuclear fusion reactors rather than this one, which is a fission reactor, there you have to simulate absolutely everything, because we have no direct experience of many of the problems from everyday experiments. We need to understand how the reactor vessel will survive neutron bombardment, can you have self-heating materials, and so on and so on. So the computational challenges in these areas are very significant. And if you want an even more significant problem, then of course all you need to do is think back to the biology example I showed in the first lecture. So, okay, lots of drivers, lots of reasons why we would quite like to have an exascale computer. When do we think it's realistic to expect such a machine to come along? Well, let's do what I said we shouldn't really do in the last lecture, and that is predict future performance on the back of what has happened in the past. So if I... this graph has got three lines on it. For all sane people, you can ignore the top one. The two lines which are interesting is the middle one. And this is the performance over time of the fastest computer in the world. So you just draw a line through where the fastest computers in the world have been for the last 15 years. Then you'll see that you hit an exaflop in around about 2018-2019. The bottom line is the 500th fastest computer in the world, and that's how that was tracked over time, and it would be an exaflop supposedly in a decade later. The top line, the one I told you to ignore, is a bit of stupidity, and it adds up the combined power of the top 500 computers in the world. I don't think it's really much interest. But so, on the basis of past experience, we could expect to see these ultra-powerful machines around about the end of the decade. In anticipation of this, DARPA is an American government funding agency that has been responsible in a number of different guises over the years for significant projects in computing. So, for example, ARPANET, one of the very first communication networks, was designed, funded under the auspices of these people. And they're still very active today in looking at leading-edge computing. They conducted a study on exascale hardware just a few years ago.
years ago. And what they wanted to do was to understand what the challenges were for mainstream computing technologies if we were to target an exascale, and if we were to get there, well, they said 2015, I pushed it back a little bit on the basis of the top 500 list, but if we were to get there within the next 5 or 10 years. And in the study, they concluded that there were 4 major challenges. The power consumption of the machine, its memory and its storage, the scalability of the applications that would run on it, and the machine resiliency. And of these 4 principal challenges, they identified power consumption as by far the most significant. Now, I would add to this list of 4 one other area which I think is absolutely essential, and that is validation. You can run a simulation as fast as you like, but if it's not really simulating reality, there was little point in doing it in the first place. How do you validate the simulations you're doing? So what I'd like to do in the next few slides basically is to go through these 5 areas in turn and explain what the challenges are. So let's start with the power problem. If you look at the most power-efficient microprocessors available today, you will find that they deliver around about 450 megaflops per watt on a thing called LINPACK. LINPACK is a numerical analysis benchmark. It is, how should we say, an optimistic benchmark. If you can get your codes to get anywhere close to LINPACK performance, you're doing remarkably well. It doesn't have lots of real stuff in it, like lots of I.O. and so on and so forth. It's a stripped-down kernel that's doing what chips do best. Anyway, so that's around about 450 megaflops per watt. If I then want to convert that and say, how much does that mean that my exaflop machine is going to consume in terms of power, then it's around 2.2 gigawatts. And that doesn't include lots of peripherals, and it doesn't include cooling. In Scotland, we are fortunate. We live in a cold climate. And so, if you have a computer in a cold climate like Scotland, you'll probably get away with an overhead on cooling around about 20%. So, that's the amount of power you've got to put into your refrigeration plant in order to suck the heat back out. If you live in the US or some hotter climate, it is not uncommon to put more power into the refrigeration plant than into the computer. So there, the overhead on the power draw is 100%. State-of-the-art, the so-called state-of-the-art in power consumption today, is around about 60% overhead. This is a worldwide average. Back at Edinburgh, where we're running Hector, as I say, we take advantage of the Scottish climate, we do 20%. I think we're doing awfully well. So let's forget about cooling overheads, let's just concentrate on the machine. We didn't give them off lots of disk and all these sorts of things as well, so it's a conservative figure. What's 2.2 gigawatts mean? Not a lot when it's written on the paper, but let's look at Scotland's largest power plant, which is Long Annet. Long Annet produces 2.4 gigawatts. So if you wanted an exaflop machine using today's most power-efficient technology, you would need Long Annet plus something more to run the cooling plant. That seems a bit unlikely. So DARPA went away and said, the solution is easy. What you have to do is cut the power consumption of the chips by an order of, by 2 orders of magnitude. And so they said, our target by 2015 is to do 100 times better in power consumption. How do you do that? Well, One of the easiest ways to reduce power on a ship is to reduce the clock rate. There are many different variables in determining what the power consumption of a microprocessor is. But there is a useful heuristic within individual architecture families, if you like. And that is, if you have a clock rate of mu, the power consumption roughly scales as mu cubed. So if you have a 20% reduction in clock rate, then by this mu cube rule, you can roughly reduce the power consumption by 50%. So this is a fairly good approach. You can get real benefits out of it. The problem, of course, is that when you've reduced the clock rate, you've also reduced the chip's ability to produce numbers for you. So if you're getting fewer numbers out. And you have to compensate for that by using more cores, more microprocessors. You have to increase the level. This is not particularly good news. I said in the first lecture, you know, we're already struggling with parallelism because of Amdahl's law and so on and so forth to get lots of performance out of very highly parallel things. And indeed, the graph on the right here shows for a set of benchmark codes what happens when they run these benchmark codes on multi-core chips as the number of processor cores went up. So the thing died off fairly rapidly as on this set of benchmarks as they went to 64 cores on the chip. So we don't want that performance. We don't want that performance either because that doesn't give us useful results. And it doesn't just happen on synthetic benchmarks on large numbers of cores per microprocessor, as we have over here. It happens on real codes, on real machines operating today. About 6 or 9 months ago, we upgraded Hector. That's the most powerful machine that we have at Edinburgh. It's, as I said before, around about 250 teraflops peak at the moment. And we upgraded it. And the upgrade was to move from 2.3 gigahertz dual-core chips to 2 gigahertz quad cores. Now, if you do the sums and you say, well, you know, this is twice as many cores, they run 10% slower, what's the increase in compute capability? And you say, well, in the upgrade we get a factor of about 1.7, 1.8. We have a code, a very well-used, heavily used, well-developed code, that instead of increasing its performance by factor 1.8, we did the upgrade, decreased its performance by factor. Was that you've got more cores, they're going a little bit more slowly, and your memory bandwidth hasn't increased. The code size. So more parallelism, yeah, it's a good way to save power, but it's not necessarily a good way to get performance.
Can I ask a question? How much power does each one of those nodes draw then?
I don't know. Can I have advanced nodes? I can tell you how many all of them draw.
Yeah, well, we could do a division if you told us how many there were.
I'll get back to you on that one. I'll think of like another. I can tell you what the monthly power bill is.
No, it's okay. I thought one was fine.
Monthly power bill is £65,000. And we buy power quite cheaply compared to the rate that you'll get it in the house, at 6.5 pence per unit. So 6.5 pence per kilowatt hour. So I could reverse engineer it if I have a few more. I don't. It's around about a megawatt. Yeah, it's around about a megawatt divided through by the number of processors.
That's the piece of information you haven't told us. How many processors are there?
Yeah. Good. That's why I have to. I'm thinking in terms of the whole machine cycle. I'll get back to you. Just taking standard chips and making them go a bit more slowly and putting more of them in there has this problem. So the question is, are standard chips the right way to go forward? One of the problems, from our point of view, is that there's a lot of real estate on a microprocessor which is dedicated to doing things like speculative execution. And that's burning up time, it's burning up energy, and actually from a computational point of view, we don't really get a lot of benefit from it. So could we make significant simplifications to the microprocessor architecture, remove all of that stuff, and get an increase in power-efficient performance. And in one sense, that's what IBM did with the BlueJeans series. So they came up with a computer, which I have to say, at Edinburgh we helped them design. We built the computer for particle physics calculations with IBM. All right? So it's a collaboration of Edinburgh, Columbia University, and IBM. We built this machine for a pretty esoteric application, and IBM thought it was such a good design that they took it, did a rather better job with the engineering, and called it BlueJean. Now, these two systems are ones that we own at Edinburgh. They're a bit long in the tooth now, actually, and will both disappear within the next few months. But if I wind the clock back, just for the purpose of comparison to around about 2003, we had this thing. This is an IBM, at this point, Power 4 machine. It has a peak performance of 5 teraflops. It is the fastest machine in the UK. It has a monthly power bill of £50,000. This, by comparison, is a one-rack BlueJean L machine. It costs a few percent of this, and it has a power bill of around about £1,000. And it has a performance on Limpac, which is 80% of all of that stuff. And it gets that by having very large numbers of slow microprocessors. It also gets faster from not having very much memory. So you wouldn't necessarily be able to run every application you could run on this thing over here. But for a number of application types, it is incredibly cost effective. So the question is, can we go back and explore different microprocessor architectures in order to Well, the answer is yes, we've got to. But you've got to remember one particular thing, and that is the microprocessor, in energy terms, isn't everything. How much energy does it cost to do a 64-bit floating point memory arm, just like that calculation up there? Well, actually, it uses about a third of the energy that costs to get the three numbers, the three operands, 20 millimetres across the die. So in energy consumption terms, moving the numbers across the microprocessor is much more energy intensive than actually doing the calculation. And if you want to go into memory, because your numbers are right there, it's 10 times more energy expensive still. So memory actually burns up an enormous amount of energy in these things. And if you haven't got the numbers locally and bringing them in, it's a real problem. So let's move from purely energy challenges to looking at the memory itself. Start with a good news story. The good news story is in the well, in both of these graphs. I'll take them in turn. The blue graph at the bottom there shows you that over the last 7 or 8 years, the bandwidth, the memory bandwidth of the chip has improved by around 2 orders of magnitude, a factor of 100. That's pretty good. At the same time, the cost of moving a bit has decreased by a factor of around about 2.5. Sorry, I said. So it's declined by around about 2.5. Unfortunately, if you combine those, although the memory bandwidth has gone up, the cost of driving the memory at full bandwidth has risen by a factor of around about 4. Getting the numbers in faster, it's costing less to move each individual number, but increasingly the memory is eating a bigger and bigger share of the energy. And this problem is not going away. If you look at this rather complicated graph, and I don't have a pointer, let's look at a number of the individual lines. The light blue line, the second one from the top, is the memory size. How much memory you get in your DRAM. And that has increased by a very significant amount, by a factor of around 75 over the past 30 years. The problem is that if you look down at the bottom there, which one is it? The microprocessor speed, which is this black one, the third from the top, okay, is increasing faster, significantly faster, than the network bandwidth rate, which is the one at the bottom. So the gap between the ability of the chip, the microprocessor, to do calculations, and our ability to feed the numbers is just getting larger and larger as time goes on. So although we've got more and more memory going on, our ability to get to use the memory effectively is reducing. And there seems to be no end to that disparity in sight. So there's a real requirement, if we're to use the machines more effectively, to come up with a novel memory technology, something that will bring the memory access rate up such that you can actually feed the microprocessors. And we'll come back to this time and time again, because actually the efficiency of computers is limited not by the ability of the microprocessors to do sums, but by the ability of the memory subsystem to keep it fed. So let's look at applications. Now we talked about application scalability being one of the real challenges. I said that few applications will scale to a teraflops. Well, here's one. It's a so-called Lattice Boltzmann. It's a particular type of algorithm, and it's being used to simulate soft condensed matter. What's soft condensed matter? Well, the gooey stuff that forms underneath the soap when it's on the soap dish for too long is an example of soft condensed matter. More interestingly, from a company's perspective, for example, would be paint or something like that, or margarine spread or something. They're interested in these sorts of things. So this application scales really well. I mean, it's scaling linearly from zero all the way up to 140,000 cores. It's doing a really good job. There you go, there's Lattice Boltzmann there. There's computational fluid dynamics, modeling combustion in an engine. So trying to improve the efficiency of fire a piston. It's doing a really good job. Some do a pretty good job. We're not getting linear scaling. We're definitely seeing the tail off as the processor count goes up, but it's not bad. But some do pretty. Now, interestingly, with this one, this is also Lattice Boltzmann. This is using the same algorithm that you saw in the first example. The difference is that it's being used in a different application where the amount of work is different. And what you're seeing here is an example of this Amdahl's law problem, that if you don't have enough work for these processors to do, then the serial component of the job starts to dominate and you don't get the scaling with increasing the number of parallel computers. So this is an example of the need in the application for the serial component, which is doing sort of global sums and this sort of thing, it's dominating. But if that was bad, then frankly there are applications which are completely alarming. Here we have a very standard chemistry type application doing density functional theory to understand the molecules and where the electrons are. As you increase the number of cores or like processors in this thing, it doesn't get better, it starts to get worse. And let me be honest, this is actually a fairly good example of some chemistry codes where in other cases they turn over at 32 or 64 cores. There are areas of science, and chemistry actually is a particularly bad example of this, where the chemists are interested in using packages. And these packages, you know, were designed 20, 30 years ago. They weren't designed with parallelism in mind. They have a locked-in audience who continue to use them, partially for sociological reasons, I think. And so these people find it very, very difficult to move. You know, there was a discussion about could you move off Fortran to some new language if a new language was better. Here we have chemists who are really locked into particular programs. Forget the languages, though. They're locked in even higher levels. It's quite difficult. Engineering was in a similar fix until relatively recently. And there in engineering, we've seen the arrival of third-party open source codes, which have revolutionized the situation, certainly things like fluid dynamics, and they're starting to move forward. So code scalability, there's a challenge in most areas. Machine resiliency, this is something that you have cursed your PC about at some point in your life, every few weeks, months, what have you, will fall over. Let's do a naive calculation. I build an exaflop computer, I'm going to have roughly 1 million microprocessors in it. If each of those microprocessors had a lifetime of 10 years, the exaflop computer would have a lifetime of 5 minutes. And that's not particularly useful, especially since the sorts of applications that will run on it are completely sensitive to single points of failure. One microprocessor goes, the whole thing stops. So how are you going to make a computer with a lifetime of 5 minutes actually do something useful for you? Well, fault tolerance isn't a new problem. And we're not the only people to be facing running jobs on millions of microprocessors. There are companies around today, Google, Amazon, the rest of you, who have warehouses full of machines like these, and they have to be able to cope with failure. They have to have resilience. And the way they do it is they have structures like this, whereby tasks are sent out from some control processors into the farm, and the results obtained. So what happens when a processor fails? Well, after some point in time, the controller will realize that this microprocessor failed, and it will resubmit that same task to another one. straightforward. So why can't we just use the same in my fugitive vector scale machine? Well, the answer is, to some extent, we can. There are a range of applications which use the same basic approach as we see with Amazon. Things like SETI at home, trying to find signals coming from little green men out in space is an obvious example. Even some of the simulations going on for Large Hadron Collider can be carried out in precisely this way. We could do DNA sequence analysis, which is a very similar problem to what we could do with the green men. The problem is, for us at any rate, that this class of application is relatively limited. If you want to do something like simulate the weather or simulate the airflow over an aircraft wing, it's a closely coupled problem where you need, you basically split the problem up into your grid, you've mapped the microprocessors, so there's my microprocessor at grid, and I've done a mapping between this physical network and the grid in my calculation, such that if this processor dies, I have a problem. An area of the calculation isn't going to be performed, and therefore, if we think about the weather, I can't tell my neighbouring cells what weather I'm experiencing, and therefore some of the boundary conditions that I'm missing. Well, there's a very straightforward answer to one aspect of this, and that is to use a fault-tolerant approach to the network, whereby you detect that this microprocessor has failed, and you simply reroute the messages that would have gone to him to some other microprocessor over on the side here. Does that solve your problem? No, it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't solve your problem is because you may well be able to reroute the messages to this chap over here, but this microprocessor over there doesn't know the state of the failed one. It doesn't know the temperature, the pressure, all of those sorts of things that the failed microprocessor was trying to calculate for this bit of the calculation. So how do you resume the calculation when now you've got a hole in the middle of it? Again, there are approaches that computer scientists know better than me for trying to solve this type of problem. We can have we can try to build resiliency into the algorithm itself, because the simple-minded approach that we as physicists might try to adopt is to use a form of checkpoint restart. In other words, every so often, I would say to each microprocessor, write the state of your memory to the disk. And then, when the processor fails, I simply go to the disk and I read in the state of the memory, wind back the calculation a bit, and start it again. And the problem with this simple mind checkpoint restart is, if the processor's failing every 5 minutes, and you've got low network bandwidth, you can't afford to write the state of the processors off the disk. So it's not scalable, you just can't do it. So can we use any of the computer science techniques that exist? Can we use any of the computer science techniques that exist in order to build some additional resiliency or fault tolerance into this? The answer is we might be able to, but there are real challenges which we do not know how to solve. For example, one of the things we could try to do is to say, well, look, I know the temperature at the 4 points surrounding my failed processor. When I restart this job on a new processor, let's assume the temperature was the average of 4. It's not a bad starting point. And I could do the same for all of the different variables I just restart. What we do not understand is how long it takes a simulation which has been disrupted like this to equilibrate back to what it would have been if the processor hadn't failed. And so and that equilibration time is application specific. So it's a lot of work that needs to be done actually to try within the applications to understand what you would do when you have this sort of failure. So there is an unsolved problem. Moving then on to my last area of validation. And I've said that before, you're doing the simulation for a real purpose. You want the output offered to mimic reality. It doesn't exactly what the problem. There are a whole variety of ways in which mistakes, errors, creep into a simulation. The hardware might get the answer wrong. You might have made the wrong choice of algorithm. You just may have made a mistake in the coding. And of these, the one that may surprise you most is the first one, the hardware unrepeatability. The hardware made a mistake. Because actually, most people simply expect the microprocessor always to give them the right answer. And it doesn't. The best known example of a commercial microprocessor not producing right answers every so often, and dates back now about 15 years, to an early Pentium where there was divide error. And about 1 in 10 billion divides were wrong. That seemed pretty infrequent, and certainly if you read the Intel marketing blurb at that time, you would agree that it wasn't something which was going to concern you. The challenge is, in an exaflop machine, if you make a mistake 1 in 9 billion times, then you make 10 to the 8 mistakes per second. So you better have hardware which is a downside more reliable than that microprocessor. In more exotic machines, we have lots of other examples of the hardware simply producing the wrong answer. One of the very first parallel computers we had at Edwards, a thing called Makerlite 60. It used a transputer-like architecture to pass messages around, and it was prone to race conditions. And so the people using it got into a mode of running every calculation 3 times. If 2 answers were the same, they believed it. Doesn't seem like a particularly solid way of doing science. More recently, I talked about the blue gene prototype that we designed at Edinburgh. We found that we needed to reduce the clock rate on that. We had hoped for 450 megahertz. Yes, it ran at 450 megahertz. There was no decimal point mistake there. We had to reduce that to about 420, or else we found similar race conditions. And that problem persisted into the blue gene, where they had to reduce the clock rate. Even more recently, on the Cray XT4, the Hector machine at Edinburgh, we've seen intermittent, undiagnosed network problems which give you lack of reproducibility. But you have to look really closely for these things. If you're a normal user, you run a piece of code, it produces an answer, you wouldn't see it. You wouldn't see these things. All you would get is the wrong answer. So, how do you check? And you have to be really diligent as a user. It's down to you to do checking at the moment. And unfortunately, there have been quite a few studies that show that silent errors, things that crop up, they may well just disappear again, and the machine has not complained, something happened. Most codes are really sensitive to silent errors. So you have to be able to have some method of trying to validate the result. And again, we can try to learn from self-stabilization approaches that computer science knows and loves in other areas. From our point of view, where we have
floating point numbers, and floating point numbers at different times in the calculation have different sensitivities. So just because something isn't a bit reproducible at one time, that might not be a problem, and another time in the calculation may be a very big problem. We simply don't understand the performance of numerical algorithms well enough to know how you could try to get self-stabilization into floating point calculations like these. And let me give you a simple example of what I'm trying to say here. So here I have an algorithm. Oops, not here I have. Here I have an algorithm. I want to sum the members of a series. And here I have an implementation. For those of you who don't recognize, this is Vita's Fortran. Okay? So I write a little loop in Fortran, and I sum the numbers up. And let me do this with some sort of real numbers. I sum them up, and I get an answer. I sum them in a different order, and I get a different answer. Which of those numbers, anyone want to guess, which of those numbers was right? No. The answer is neither of them was, actually. They both exhibited rounding error, and the order of the calculation made the rounding error go in different ways, and so they flip. I don't quite understand how the rounding error worked, because actually the correct answer would have had a 0.3 at the end, but you can see that this sort of thing could quite easily give you a really big problem if you were coming to some very large numbers of numbers, as most of these calculations will do. The algorithmic choice, that was a simple example. I'm not going to blind you with lots of different equations. I just wanted to make you feel for the poor computational scientist that actually has to make decisions about what algorithms to use. Here's a simple example where what I have to do is to solve some equation, this thing up here, Poisson's equation. The second derivative of some function phi equals some other function rho. And I'm going to try and solve this on a two-dimensional grid. So what have I got here down here is I've got my grid, and in each of the grid points I've got some value for phi, and I've got some value for rho. And in order to solve Poisson's equation, clearly what I have to do is I have to differentiate phi and I can do that. So how am I going to differentiate phi? Let's just worry about the first differential for a moment, d phi by dx. Well, there are two approaches I could take. I could take what's called a forward scheme. In other words, if I want to calculate the differential at the center point here, I could take the value of phi in the center point, compare it with the value over on the left or alternatively on the right, doesn't matter. Take the difference between these two and divide by the separation, delta, the physical separation between the two points, and I would get this thing up here that I call the forwards differential. I could take a different approach, and I could take the value on either side, and now these two points are separated by 2 delta, and I get the centered approximation for the differential. They don't look very different, but they behave very differently in terms of the error associated with them. So you try to use this one at the top, what you find is that the forward scheme gives you an error that's this last term here, this delta over 2 term, gives you an error which goes as delta, whereas the centered scheme gives you an error which goes as delta squared. In other words, this centered model is very much more accurate than the forward scheme. But yet, computation is the same, and they didn't look very different. So if you're not careful, you make the wrong choice, you go off in the wrong direction. And in fact, if you want to continue this analysis, actually to solve Poisson's equation and calculate what d2 phi by dx squared is, and you use the forward scheme,
then the error goes as 1 over del for forwards, or it goes as del squared. The separation squared if you use the center of speed. No, big, big difference. So basic differentiation, very different. You have to think about it on the grid. If you want to solve another equation, which now has got 2 terms in it, we've got that del squared phi thing again, so there's some sort of spatial term. But now phi is varying as time goes on, so this is what's called the initial value problem. You know the state of something at time zero, you want to calculate the state of something at some later time. There are whole sorts of ways that you can try to differentiate this in space and in time. And we've learned from the previous slide that if you're going to do the spatial differentiation, you better be have it centered. But we're going to try a thing which is forward in time, that's the FT in the FTCS. To do that, it's easy to do, it's easy to calculate, but it's unstable. Unless you have a time slice which is very, very small. So you say, what am I going to do about this? And you try a different approach. And this is the one that's at the bottom here, a bit more complicated to calculate, so-called implicit scheme. And this is great, because this one now is stable in time. It's just not very accurate. So in fact, for this, and you don't know any of this, it's just an example, if you're going to try and solve this, what you do is you come up with a scheme which is called Kramp-Nicholson. You take the explicit scheme and the implicit and you average them. And by a miracle, you come up with a scheme which is both stable in time and actually accurate. So you say, now I know what to do when I have an equation which looks like this. Well, that equation looks awfully like the one that I put on the previous slide. It's got a del squared phi on the other hand, on this side, and it's got a d phi by dt on this side. The only difference between this equation and this one is this one was d phi by dt, and this one's d2 phi by dt squared. And if you try to use Kramp-Nicholson on an equation that looks like that, you'll just get rubbish. So the algorithm crucially depends on the equation. And when you have a simulation where the thing being studied is just changing state, for example, in turbulent flow near an aircraft wing or something, sometimes you could have an equation that looks like this, sometimes you could have an equation that looks like the other, and your solver better be the right one at the right time, or you're going to get rubbish. So there's a simple example of how you better be sure that you know what you're doing and you're using the correct algorithm. And lastly, you just may make a mistake in writing down the piece of code. Most developers of scientific codes haven't been through a CS degree. They do not even understand what the term software engineering means. They do it by luck and prayer and hope and all those sorts of things. So we have to get more software engineering into the design process. The fortunate thing is that none of these software developers that I've just parodied, when they make mistakes, it's not going to kill anyone. Because there are examples where there are good examples of wrong software coding where people have died. Here's an example of the Ariane 5 explosion. What they did here was they took the same code that they used for Ariane 4, forgot that with those more powerful boosters, they generated some numbers which were out of range. The software didn't know what to do with numbers that were out of range, and the machine blew up, which was a bit unfortunate. Unfortunately, no one was up in the Ariane, so it was a satellite or two that went down. But this example really did kill people. And you'll know more about than I do. But it's an example, again, of concurrent programming, where they didn't actually understand the prioritization of different threads in the program. And so real errors could creep through, and a significant number of people could die as a result of that. So our mistakes, from a computational science point of view, are going to be much less dramatic than these, but no less important in terms of the scientific output. Formal verification would produce a good alternative approach to ad hoc testing, which is what in the best circles happens today. There are challenges for applying formal testing techniques. Again, in real world programs, we're at a floating point. You don't really understand how sensitive some of the numbers are to change. But I think one of the things that we do have to look at is an extension of formal techniques into validation of the software. And that actually is it. The lecture, sorry, it was run slightly over, but